I have to apologize that my plan has been sort of turned upside down. I had arranged for Jacob himself to come this morning and tell his story, but it didn't work out, because what I was going to do next week was just going to take too much time, and I had to leave Jacob. I had to let Jacob pass by. So I just thought it would have been a little bit different if we actually had the biblical character turn up, you know. he may come another time. What we are going to do is still a little bit unusual. You probably have not heard many teachings like this, but we're actually going to take a look at the Jacob cycle through the lens of family systems. We're going to take a critical look at Jacob's family system. Because we read the Bible as a religious text from within the faith community. Where were we? Because we read the Bible as a religious text from within the faith community that holds it as the supreme authority for faith and life, we tend to read it with rose-tinted glasses, or more precisely, with religious-tinted glasses that we didn't get from Specsavers. That can separate us from the biblical characters. That can separate the biblical characters out from the rough and tumble of daily life and make them somehow different from us. Maybe we think in terms of them as better than us, or they had that X factor that we don't have. But we might even fail to see that God does his transforming work in the lives of ordinary people. People like you. And the kind of people we meet every day in our families, in our homes, in our work, in our schools, and community. Every sort of person with all their individual propensities and quirks of character. How do we look at the Christmas story, for example? We've transformed the horror of giving birth in unsanitary conditions in a stable into beautiful art and craft forms in Christmas cards and manger scenes. And it's become romantic instead of horror. Here we go. Nowhere is this more true in how we read the stories of the patriarchs. They are, after all, the fathers of our faith. Their stories have an epic-like quality for us, and they themselves are the heroes of the epic. They have shaped for us what faith looks like, and as with all our heroes, from whatever context, we try to emulate them. Sure, we pay lip service to their weaknesses, our bad points, and when we deal with them, we point to these as evidence of what the grace of God that the grace of God can transform us to. The problem is we don't pay sufficient attention to the real context of their lives, in which their growth in faith took place. We admire Abraham's faith in offering Isaac and laud his obedience to God, but spend so little time in contemplation of the struggle and the process that Abraham must have gone through before he arrived at the point of obedience that would allow him to offer Isaac in the faith that God would raise him from the dead. That must have been an absolute horrendous struggle. But it's just a few verses in the Bible that we don't stop and think. As we journey through the Jacob cycle today and next Sunday, we're going to take a realistic look at Jacob's family and the dynamics that are at play within it, to bring, first of all, a degree of realism to the Bible story, an understanding that God works through very ordinary people, families, and communities in all their brokenness and even their dysfunction to further his purposes and establish his kingdom on earth. Some of you may be familiar with systems thinking as it applies to family counseling, etc. But what I propose to do then today is to take a look at Jacob through a family systems lens, which will bring out some of the horror of how this family operated, and yet how God, through his grace, transformed Jacob into a prince with God, Israel. In the process, I'll try to do justice to the whole story of Jacob himself. Within family counseling theory today, there's a growing awareness that in situations of difficulty within a family, the problem is often not just with the family member exhibiting the problematic behavior, but with the whole family system itself. The problem just surfaces and finds expression around one person who is the identified patient of the family system. Consequently, the family counselor will often want to see the whole family and endeavor to treat the family system as a whole, not just the individual member. That's all very interesting, you might say, but this is Sunday morning church service and we're supposed to be listening to the Word of God. What has family systems theory got to do with our study of Jacob and our worship? Shouldn't we, this type of study belong in the counseling classes, in counseling class? Well, yes, but relationships are the stuff of life. It is where God's transforming work takes place. Every significant event in Jacob's life and in ours takes place in the context of family relationships. So looking at them from within that context should be profitable and should lead us to worship. Hopefully it does anyway. The book of Genesis provides a window into Jacob's family system over several generations. The large amount of material from Genesis 25 to 35 allows us to see Jacob function in a variety of interpersonal relationships in different family contexts. We see him as a brother, as a son, as a nephew, as a husband, and a father. We will have a look at Jacob in each of these roles as we process through his story. But before we go any further, it's important to remind ourselves that Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel by God, is one of the most important of the Old Testament patriarchs. The whole nation of God's people will ultimately be named after him. And even us as the church are the Israel of God. Among other things, in his story, we see the journey of a man from scheming selfishness to becoming a prince with God. Jacob himself was not a very commendable person, but he was transformed by grace. We see also that God works the transformation through the normal events and relationships of life and through very ordinary means, teaching us that transformation does not usually happen through some sort of mystical experience taking place in a vacuum. And very often, you know, particularly people who've been touched by charismatic renewal, they expect that magic zap that changes their lives and makes them into a different kind of person. But it is worked out in our relationships with others, with those among whom we live and work and play, and especially among the members of our own families as we receive and cooperate with God's grace in our lives. Struggle and strife in Jacob's family. In the Jacob cycle, family relationships are dominated by struggle and strife, what Michael Fishbane calls the recurrent thematic emblem of the cycle as a whole. Thus we see the brothers Jacob and Esau struggle, first of all in the womb. The children struggle together within her, that's within Rebekah. And she said, "If it is to be like this, why do I live?" Secondly, they struggle at birth. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand gripping Esau's heel, so he was named Joseph, Jacob. And then they struggled in their youth. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man living in the tents. Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Uh-oh, trouble. Jacob's flight into exile in Padan Aram is merely an exchange of his conflict with Esau for conflict with the master of deceit himself, his uncle Laban. Jacob's beloved wife Rachel struggles with his first wife Leah in what becomes a horrifying battle, with each wife wanting what the other has. Rachel has Jacob's love but wants his children, while Leah has his children but wants his love. Rachel's statement in verse 8, when the slave wife she provides for Jacob, her maidservant Bilhah, produces a second son, is nothing less than a triumphant boast that allows us to see the level of tension in the relationship. Then Rachel said, "With mighty wrestlings I have wrestled with my sister and have prevailed." So she named him Naphtali. In Middle Eastern culture, this is just a footnote, in Middle Eastern culture at that time, a barren wife was required to provide a slave wife for her husband, and the children resulting from this union were regarded as the wife's. Indeed, the fracas in the family played out in chapter 30, as we shall see, almost makes current daytime TV soap operas pale in comparison. How, we may wonder, will this family ever become the descendants through whom the peoples of the earth would be blessed? As the Lord had said to Jacob at Bethel, and the Lord stood beside him and said, "I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your offspring, and your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, and to the north and the south, and all the families of the earth shall be blessed in you and in your offspring." What? In this family? In the end, it will take no less than a wrestling match with God himself to bring Jacob into submission, from which will emerge a renewed relationship with God and with his long estranged brother Esau. Genesis 25:28 gives us a direct insight into the beginning of the emotional triangles in the family. Isaac and his wife Rebekah each have a favorite child through whom they relate or fail to relate to each other. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man living in the tent. Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Isaac himself probably learned his favoritism pattern from his father Abraham, though there are signs that in the Abraham cycle, that Abraham's favoritism was not as pronounced as we see it in Isaac and subsequently in Jacob. And here's Jacob repeating the pattern. "Now Israel loved Joseph more than any of his other children because he was the son of his old age. And we said to my Lord, 'We have a father, an old man.'" This is the brother saying to Joseph. "An old man and a young brother, the child of his old age. His brother is dead. He alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him." Is there some sort of distancing going on in that statement too? The reason for Isaac's preference of Esau is due to his physical appetites. He had a taste for wild game. And Esau was a skillful hunter rather than any spiritual reasons. Harry, or Red, as his brother nicknamed him, that's Esau, was the antithesis of his younger brother Jacob. He was the macho man of the patriarchal period, the outdoors man who loved to go hunting and loved life in the fields. We could describe him as a real he-man. Jacob, on the other hand, was a quiet, reserved kind of guy. He was the stay-at-home type who liked life around the tents, which probably means that he enjoyed the company of the family community, which would include women and servants. It is not at all surprising that Rebekah loved him. He could be relied on to be there, to be company for her whenever she needed him. Accordingly, he was probably more cultured than his brother Esau. We would naturally expect in two such different characters a fair degree of rivalry and competition. What we encounter at the end of chapter 5 is sibling rivalry at its best, or worst. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man living in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he was fond of game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once, when Jacob was cooking a stew, Esau came in from the field and he was famished. Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stuff, for I am famished." Therefore he was called Edom. And Jacob said, "First sell me your birthright." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me first." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Brothers, or what? What would it? Yep. Was the blessing? The blessing in birth. The birthright is the actual right to inheritance, and the blessing is what goes with that. The two absolutely go together. What would it have cost Jacob to feed his brother? After all, the stew was made, and it was probably large enough to feed the whole family, and possibly the servants as well. In reflecting on this incident, we also need to remember the cultural context of the patriarchs. We're dealing here with a context where extending hospitality to the visitor or even the stranger was a cultural norm. To fail to provide for the visitor, even if he was unexpected, would be a source of shame for the household. If necessary, the family would go without themselves in order to entertain the visitor as lavishly as their means would allow. You probably saw that in Nepal. This is also the background to Jesus' parable of the friend coming at midnight. But we're not talking about stranger here. We're talking brother. Jacob was treating his brother in a way he would never dream of treating a stranger. For him, Esau's hunger was an opportunity to be exploited, to be used to his advantage, but at his brother's expense. And he used it to the fullest extent, wangling the birthright from him. In biblical understanding, Jacob's behavior is wickedness, pure and simple. Biblical understanding, the biblical definition of wickedness, Bruce Waltke says, is to advantage yourself by disadvantaging others. When you take advantage of someone else to advantage yourself, that is wickedness in biblical understanding. And Jacob here is absolutely guilty of wickedness. But if we think Jacob can be scheming and deceitful, wait until we meet wonderful Uncle Laban, who will treat his own flesh and blood worse than his enemies. But aren't families like that sometimes? And because they are, there are times, it is sad to say, when in pastoral counseling or other kind of counseling, we will need to counsel married couples to treat their spouse as they would a total stranger, and brothers as if they had never met each other before. Sad to say that we can treat those in our family worse than we would treat strangers. Now, the contribution of Isaac and Rebekah to the whole thing, although the strife between Jacob and Esau in Genesis 25 is based on Jacob's greed, the very fact that we know each son was triangled by the parents would have greatly increased the natural reactiveness the twin brothers would have to one another. How could the brothers have failed to pick up the opposing ambitions for their lives that was born in their parents' favoritism? This is clarified even more in chapter 27, where Rebekah encourages and helps Jacob to steal the blessing. A bad air day. Several years later, journeying into the future, past the famine in Canaan and the family's consequent sojourn in Gerar with Abimelech, where Isaac denies that Rebekah is his wife and so risks the possibility that she might be taken by Abimelech or one of his people. I wonder what that did for the relationship. We come to that fateful day when the dysfunction in Jacob's family will finally cause it to break up. The family, as we shall see, has soured over time. The theme of family conflict between the parents, between parents and children, and between the twins now becomes full-blown in pursuit of the patriarchal blessing. Should we read the whole thing? Have we time? When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called his elder son Esau and said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am." He said, "See, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me. Then prepare for me savory food such as I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may bless you before I die." Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. I wonder, was it outside the tent? So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "I heard your father say to your brother Esau, 'Bring me game and prepare for me savory foods to eat, that I may bless you before the Lord, before I die.' Now therefore, my son, obey my word as I command you. Go to the flocks and get me two choice kids, so that I may prepare from them savory food for your father, such as he likes. And you shall take it to your father to eat, so that he may bless you before he dies." But Jacob said to his mother Rebekah, "Look, my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I am a man of smooth skin. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall seem to be mocking him and bring a curse on myself and not a blessing." His mother said to him, "Let your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my word and go get them for me." So he went and got them and brought them to his mother, and his mother prepared savory food such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of her elder son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them on her younger son Jacob. And she put the skins on the kids, the skins of the kids on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. Then she handed the savory food and the bread that she had prepared to her son Jacob. So he went in to his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Now sit up and eat of my game, so that you may bless me." But Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you have found it so quickly, my son?" He answered, "Because the Lord, your God, granted me success." Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Come near, that I may feel you, my son, and know whether you are really my son Esau or not." So Jacob went up to his father Isaac, who felt him, and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." He did not recognize him, because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. He said, "Are you really my son Esau?" He answered, "I am." Then he said, "Bring it to me, that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it to him, and he ate, and he brought him wine, and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and kiss me, my son." So he came near and kissed him, and he smelled the smell of his garments and blessed him and said, "Ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let the people serve you and the nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you." As soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, when Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of his father Isaac, his brother Esau came in from his hunting. He also prepared savory food and brought it to his father. And he said to his father, "Let my father sit up and eat of his son's game, so that you may bless me." His father Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" And he answered, "I am your firstborn, Esau." Then Isaac trembled violently and said, "Who was it then that hunted game and brought it to me? And I ate it all before you came, and I have blessed him. Yes, and blessed he shall be." When Esau heard his father's word, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me also, father." But he said, "Your brother came deceitfully, and he has taken away your blessing." Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright, and look, now he has taken away my blessing." Then he said, "Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" Isaac answered Esau, "I have already made him your lord, so I have given him all his brothers. I have given him all his brothers as servants, and with grain and wine I have sustained him. What can I do for you, my son?" Esau said to his father, "Have you only one blessing, father? Bless me also, father." And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Then his father Isaac answered him, "See, away from the fatness of the earth shall your home be, and away from the dew of heaven on high. But by your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. And when you break loose, you shall break his yoke from your neck." Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching when I will kill my brother Jacob." But the words of her elder son Esau were told to Rebekah, and so she sent and called her younger son Jacob and said to him, "Your brother Esau is consoling himself by planning to kill you. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice. Flee at once to my brother Laban in Haran and stay with him a while until your brother's fury turns away, until your brother's anger against you turns away and he forgets what you have done to him. Then I will send and bring you back from there. Why should I lose both of you in one day?" Then Rebekah said to Isaac, "I am weary of my life because of the Hittite women. If Jacob marries one of the Hittite women such as these, one of the women of the land, what good will my life be to me?" This type of blessing, which both Jacob and Esau desired, were usually end-of-life blessings. And they were a kind of bequest to one's sons. As they were closely associated with the birthright, they were very significant indeed, and were normally given in public. Jacob's blessing of his sons in chapter 49 is a good example. So is Joseph's in chapter 50. So in 49, we see, "Then Jacob called his sons and said, 'Gather round that I may tell you what will happen in the days to come.'" It's the action preliminary to the blessing. He then goes on to bless his sons. And when it comes to Joseph's turn, he says, "Then Joseph said to his brothers, 'I'm about to die, but God will surely come to you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob.'" And Joseph gives the blessing. Bad hair day continued. The very fact that Isaac gave the blessing in secret should cause red warning lights to go off in our minds. This should have been a very important moment in the life of this family, at which all the members were present and participating. It was not something Isaac should have done in secret without the knowledge or presence of his spouse and his other son. The secrecy allows us a glimpse into the true state of this family's relationships. Family secrets are a sign of emotional anxiety in the system and become transmitters of anxiety from generation to generation, as is happening here before our eyes. With what appears to be an obvious emotional cutoff between Isaac and Rebekah, their differences over who should receive the birthright and blessing are fought through their children rather than being dealt with between themselves. On the surface, Rebekah seems to have good intentions. After all, the prophecy given in 25:23, which foretold that the older will serve the younger, gives her some justification, at least in her own mind, for her actions. She's merely helping God out. Poor God. But the end does not justify the means, though Rebekah clearly thinks it does. One thing is for certain. The way this family is behaving, not one of them is going to come from this episode smelling like roses. Before going any further, we need to take a look at how emotional triangles work. Triangles in relationship always have three categories of people. There's the persecutor, the victim, the rescuer, so that the triangle looks like this. You have a persecutor who persecutes the victim. You have the relationship between the victim and the rescuer going at the persecutor. As we've said, there's an emotional cutoff between Isaac and Rebekah in what appears to have become a very conflicted relationship. The tragedy is that if ever there was a match made in heaven, it was this. 2 weeks ago, in our character study of Isaac, Tom told us how Abraham sent his servant to his relatives to find a wife for his son Isaac. We saw that the servant prayed for and received the Lord's guidance to Rebekah, who is clearly portrayed in the narrative as God's choice of bride for Isaac. Our expectations for this marriage are high. We expect it to work out, but instead we discover serious conflict and communication problems. The example of Jacob and Rebekah brings home to us the sobering truth that while a match may be made in heaven, the marriage still has to be made on earth and is the responsibility with God's grace of the husband and wife. It takes commitment, preferring each other in love, and continuing communication to keep it from growing cold. from love at first sight. We see that when Isaac and Rebekah's eyes meet for the first time, and all this happened before Hollywood. Isaac went out in the evening to walk in the field, and looking up, he saw the camels coming. And Rebekah looked up, and when she saw Isaac, she slipped quickly from the camel and said to the servant, "Who is this man over there walking in the field to meet us?" The servant said, "It is my master." So she took her veil and covered herself. And the servant told Isaac all the things that he had done. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent. He took Rebekah and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. So we move from love at first sight and children conceived in prayer after a 20-year wait. Isaac prays for Rebekah and she conceives. Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord granted his prayer. And his wife, Rebekah, conceived. After all of that, the family relationships take a turn for the worst. Isaac is the common enemy, the persecutor, in the Rebekah-Jacob triangle. And Rebekah is the common enemy in the Isaac-Esau triangle, with each parent trying to rescue their victim son from the persecuting spouse. Isaac wants to bless Esau because he is his favorite. And besides, the special blessing belongs to the oldest, who has the right of inheritance. This is the way we've always done it, and we're not changing for you, Mrs. Rebekah, with the prophetic word to back her up, stands in the way. She, for her part, wants her favorite son, Jacob, to receive the blessing. And Isaac, with his stubborn refusal to listen to God's will, stands in her way. Each parent is forced to become the rescuer of their favorite against the unreasonableness of the spouse. And just in case the reader of the saga hasn't picked up the dynamics at work, the narrator, the biblical writer, even refers to Esau as his, Isaac's son Esau, and Jacob as her, that is Rebekah's son Jacob. The effects of such dysfunctional relationship will continue in the story. The repetition of the phrase "tasty food" in the narrative, oh, it's a pity that's all come up at once, in the narrative, proves that Rebekah knows what every woman knows, that the way to a man's heart is through his stomach. Now, not much has changed in the last 4,000 years. No, actually, it shows how fickle the foundation of Isaac's favoritism really was. If the effects of such foolishness weren't so tragic, we might even laugh. Instead, we weep at a family system about to go mobile. Isaac acts on his physical rather than his spiritual sense, and as has become the pattern of his life, he's too passive and irresolute in the exercise of his leadership in the family. Rebekah, for her part, acts on domination of Jacob, "Do what I say," she tells him, and deception of Isaac, which was probably necessary in a patriarchal system if she was to have any hope of getting her way. And Esau reveals his character by breaking the oath he made to Jacob in 25:33. The birthright and blessing always went together. Esau made an oath, swore an oath to Jacob over the incident with the stew, and now he is breaking that by looking for the blessing. Jacob said, "Swear to me first," so he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. So later he resolves to kill his brother, and the text says he hated his brother Jacob. And good old Jacob, he's a very willing co-conspirator with his mother, and he blasphemously lies to his father in order to get the blessing. As a consequence, he will now have to pay very severely for his deceitfulness. So reaping the fruit of their actions. The divine verdict on the actions of each of the family members is guilty. You bet you never thought that before. You never read the story like that. As the resulting fallout will demonstrate, the family is about to reap the consequence of its failure to deal with its dysfunctionality. Rebekah's self-proclaimed prophecy, "Let the curse fall on me," will come true as she loses both sons and will die without ever seeing her favorite son, Jacob, again. And after this incident, when Jacob leaves, Rebekah passes out of the biblical record and is never mentioned again. And in Jewish understanding, that is akin to being cursed. Her name is gone. Esau will have no part in the sacred history because he treated the birthright, which included the right of priesthood in the family, and the promises that went with it so lightly. He becomes the father of Edom, the Edomites, who are constantly at war with Israel. Isaac lives on for another 103 years, incidentally, which was rather interesting because he thought he was about to die when he was given the blessing. He had another 103 years. But he lives on without any further significance. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years, and he lives with a fractured family for most of his life. You know, every sermon I heard about Isaac, he's a type of Christ. I don't think Jesus quite matches. As for Jacob, he will experience the same pain, that of a fractured family, as a direct consequence of following the same pattern of favoritism in his own family. It was the favoritism he had for Joseph that led to his brother's plot to kill him, and they settled for selling him as a slave. We need to keep in mind that unresolved behavioral patterns and issues are transmitted from generation to generation and will continue to reap destruction in future family relationships until they are dealt with. And that is something we really do need to keep in mind. The most immediate result for Jacob is that he has to flee from his brother's fratricidal wrath as the identified patient of a sick family system. Years later, Jacob will also be deceived in like fashion by his own sons in what seems to be clear poetic justice. Then they took Joseph's robe, slaughtered a goat, and dipped the robe in the blood. They had the long robe with the sleeves taken to their father, and they said, "This we have found. See now whether it is your son's robe or not." He recognized it and said, "It is my son's robe. A wild animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Family favoritism reaches its climax. To be continued next week. Oh, and any questions? Because I'm sure this is a look at Jacob such as you have never had before. She's never mentioned again. She passes out of the biblical record. And she was helping God out. She was the one who was standing for the prophetic word, but she took it into her own hands and did it her own way. Sobering thought. I mean, how often do we want to help God out?
How do we recognize these cycles and how do we work out?
Well, I mean, if I look at my family of origin, my father was a placator, always placating my mother. I can still see him coming home late from work, and my mother angry because the dinner is spoiled, and the two hands are going, I couldn't help it. Somebody came into the office. I repeated my father's placating patterns. Joan, my first wife, repeated the family patterns in her family, and she lived on her emotions. and the emotion, the decision that would be made today on one set of emotions would be reversed next week or next month or in 6 months' time on a new set of emotions. And there was no rationality to it. And I placated. I thought I was turning the other cheek and walking the other mile, and all I was doing was empowering inappropriate behaviors. And it ultimately, after 20 years, was an irredeemable situation. It was only in counseling that I recognized, I mean, I thought I was innocent. And while I may have been blameless in terms of my motives of turning the other cheek and walking the other mile, I was not faultless. In fact, my repetition of my father's placating patterns had empowered behavioral patterns that became irredeemable. Get help early. That's all I can say. Get help early. And it is, yeah.
It's possible to write that written text of silence, but it doesn't quite.
And it's not easy. The discomfort that I have, even today, after discovering this 13 years ago, that I have in not placating, in actually confronting. It's still quite traumatic for me to do that. So it's never easy. Absolutely. And it's learning how to manage conflict and manage difference that's crucial to healthy communities, healthy families, healthy churches. How many churches split because we don't know how to handle conflict or resolve conflict properly? How many families break up for the same reason? People who love each other. I mean, Isaac and Rebecca loved each other, and there's nothing in the story to indicate that ever changed, other than they both have an agenda around their children, and they engage in inappropriate behaviors of trying to get their own way. You know, I mean, and as to some families even. Some couples even express intimacy through conflict. Always fighting, love one another to bits, but always fighting, and it's the way. And this was one of the things I see. My oldest daughter Ruth and her mother Joan, the way they express intimacy to each other is always conflict. And I mean, I can remember Ruth was about 13, 14 at the time, and I said to her, I said, "Look, Ruth, if you want to do something, come and talk to me first. You know I listen and evaluate. You know your mom is just going to say no, and then the conflict starts, and everybody in the house is upset." So Ruth started to come to me, can I do this? And I'd listen and say, yeah, okay, that's okay. Then she'd go and ask her mom. And the conflict would start and go on for an hour. And then Ruth said, "Well, I'm doing it anyway because I asked Dad, and he said I could." And then we had more stuff.
I think the mistaken combination of inappropriate
the other cheek.
But I also think that in learning that, it's really important to learn what is going to help you on that. So that gets swallowed
over the other way, yeah. Act rather than react, yeah.
Yeah, but I think that the hallmark of true Christian, I think, or of the women's high-level emotional maturity is to be able to open to
But it's, I wanted to do something a bit different because when we're sort of going through the Old Testament, I mean, we have a basic familiarity with the story, and the story tends to be told the same way, and we miss the sub narrative, the subtext, and I mean it. Well, that's what I was trying to do.
And it's just interesting to see that the same nonsense we've got in our way back then.
But the thing that this family is the bearer of the promise, you know, this, it's the bearer of the promise. And I mean, what kind of hope and confidence does that give to us in our situation, you know, in our situations, in our families, in our context, yeah.